Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today I'm going to be my own guest and talk about specific nutrient. You know, we've done a series of clinical focus broadcasts on the subjects that relate to disease or relate to specific supplements. Today we're going to tackle a supplement that is of extraordinary value. And there is some controversy about the best way to obtain it. So hopefully this clinical focus would shed some light on the supplement sulforaphane. Sulforaphane is really one of the most exciting nutrients in the integrative medicine armamentarium. There is a new word in the lexicon of science, and that word is chemoprevention. You know, we talk about chemotherapy as a way of destroying cancer. Chemoprevention is a buzzword because just as we'd like to prevent cardiovascular disease with statin drugs, and that still remains somewhat of a dubious, controversial proposition, for some beneficial, for a lot not, and for many carrying side effects. This is a bonanza, no question, to the pharmaceutical industry. So science, medicine, big pharma, constantly on the lookout for chemoprotective agents that could shield us against cancer. And fortunately or unfortunately, fortunately for us who are fans of nutritional supplements, unfortunately for the pharmaceutical industry, the best chemopreventive agents are made by Mother Nature. And sulforaphane is one of them. It is actually derived from a precursor compound called glucoraphanin. Glucoraphanin is found in plentiful amounts in Brussels sprouts, cabbage, cauliflower, bok choy, kale, collards, Chinese broccoli, broccoli rabe, kohlrabi, mustard, turnip greens, radish, arugula, and watercress. So there's a little bit of a trick to this, though, because the glucoraphanin needs to be converted into sulforaphane for it to be valuable. But we'll come back to that in just a moment. The initial work on sulforaphane began in the early 1990s. With Paul Talalay and his associates. He's now in his 90s and he's retired, but 25 years ago or so, he was in his prime doing research at Johns Hopkins Medical School. And his group demonstrated for the first time that sulforaphane is a potent inducer of detoxification pathways. The body has ways of getting rid of toxins, and that's part of our natural defense. And one of the main ways in which we get rid of toxins is through something called the glutathione pathway. We've heard often about the benefits of glutathione. There's some controversy over whether glutathione is absorbed when taken orally. It may be broken down and therefore not that well absorbed, although there's some newer ways of getting it into the system, past the digestive system. Or, of course, you can use intravenous glutathione, but that's expensive and time-consuming. And what's interesting is that you can actually get the body to make more glutathione. And sulforaphane is one of the ways of getting the body to induce the enzyme glutathione peroxidase, which is a key part of our detoxification defenses. And it turns out that this has vast implications for cancer. In particular, it seems, cancer of the prostate and breast and lung, there's some strong indications that sulforaphane may have protective and even potentially curative effects in these cancers. And this all is an outgrowth of the work of Paul Talalay in the 1990s. We've known about it since, you know, the early mid part of my medical career. So early on, The work led to the development and commercialization of a potent source of sulforaphane, possibly the best source, which is broccoli sprouts. And they created a branded product called Brocco Sprouts. And this was said to be a strain of broccoli which was maximized for delivery of sulforaphane. You know, not all broccolis are alike. They differ in their chemical composition. And so through research and possibly breeding, they created a supercharged broccoli sprout. But there's an interesting sidelight to this, because the efforts of the Johns Hopkins group to claim proprietary rights over their own branded sulforaphane Brocco sprouts were actually overturned by a court decision that ruled that you can't patent Mother Nature. And I'll read for you from a website called sproutnet.com. And I think that this is a website that's put up by people who put up sprouts, and were very happy and rejoiced over the decision that the Johns Hopkins group did not have a lock, proprietary, patent on the cancer protective properties of broccoli sprouts. I'm reading here from the website. We are basically elated at the results, says Larry Ravitz, owner of Banner Mountain Sprouts, which employs eight and sells sprouts to the Raley's Inc. supermarket chain and Northern California wholesalers. The judge granted everything that we asked for. The ruling addresses a dispute that began last October, this is a few years back, when Johns Hopkins University and Brassica Protection Products, a Maryland company that claimed rights to commercialize two patents owned by the university. The university and Brassica claimed the patents gave them and their distributors, who pay the company royalties, the exclusive right to sprout broccoli seed and sell it as a food. Well, there's something un-American about that. So, in June of 1999, actually, Brassica was the plaintiff. They sued, claiming patent infringement by a business called Sprout Man Inc. And Sprout Man Inc. claimed, rightfully so, that people had known for years that broccoli seeds could be sprouted and eaten, and asked the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to re-examine the patent. So this resulted in a series of legal cases, and in one of the final decisions, a Judge Nickerson said that U.S. patent law prevents the granting of patents that describe, quote, a prior art, meaning a practice that's already been described. Plaintiffs also do not claim that their patents involve doing anything to alter or modify the natural seeds. They're simply germinated, harvested, and eaten. And, now you can get broccoli sprouts made by a variety of manufacturers. You can't patent, Mother Nature. What specifically sulforaphane does? It's an inducer of what are called phase two enzymes. There are actually two phases of detoxification, phase one and phase two. And phase two is particularly important in detoxification. So in a landmark paper in 1992, entitled A Major Inducer of Anti-Carcinogenic Protective Enzymes from Broccoli, Isolation and Elucidation of Structure, that's a fancy way of saying we figured out what's in broccoli that has the detoxifying properties. They say sulforaphane is the most potent inducer. Sulforaphane and its sulfide induced both quinone reductase and glutathione transferase activities, and the induction of detoxification enzymes by sulforaphane may be a significant component of the anti-carcinogenic action of broccoli, which everybody knows about because for generations, mothers have been telling kids, eat your broccoli. So it took science decades and decades to figure out why that turns out to be a good idea. But here's the problem. What if you're one of the estimated 40% of adults that surveys show have an aversion to broccoli and related cabbage family vegetables? Perhaps you're one of those people, although health-conscious individuals tend to like broccoli, and even if they don't necessarily care for the taste, they kind of force themselves and learn to like it. But there's a lot of people that have an aversion to broccoli. And there are reasons for that, other than just general finickiness and lack of dietary discipline. Some people are bitter tasters. That's a genetic trait that increases the taste buds' sensitivity to the intense flavors of plant polyphenols, which is actually an advantage from an evolutionary standpoint because some plant polyphenols, if consumed in excess, are poisons. So there's a certain percentage of people in the population that can't handle this. And it's interesting that this actually switches when women become pregnant. They become more sensitive to bitter taste. They have an aversion to things that they might have previously liked. Also, children in general have a lower threshold for bitter taste and thus are finicky eaters. I personally was one of those kids. I never ate anything like broccoli until I was about, I don't know, 13, 14, 15. That's when I started becoming more adventuresome, and it also coincided with puberty. And there are probably some changes that change the characteristic of the taste buds that allow people, even genetically prone bitter tasters. By the way, I did a genetic analysis on 23andMe, and I found that I have the gene for bitter taste, that I am a bitter taster, and thus more likely to follow a fastidious diet. Although now I'm omnivorous. I'll just, there's almost nothing that daunts me. Or alternatively, I mean, there's another reason why people don't want to eat a lot of these cabbage family vegetables. Maybe you're one of the many who get terrible gas and indigestion from cruciferous vegetables. And there's a reason for that. Patients who have irritable bowel syndrome sometimes get a benefit from something called the FODMAP diet. That's FODMAP. And FODMAP is short for various food groups of indigestible carbohydrates, which include fructans, that's the F, oligosaccharides, that's the O, the D is disaccharides, the M is monosaccharides, the A is just for and P is for polyols. Polyols are sugar alcohols, like sorbitol and xylitol. And so patients with IBS who follow the FODMAP diet may benefit. They have less IBS. And cruciferous vegetables are high in the O, in the oligosaccharide component. They also have a high sulfur content. And that, in some individuals, can contribute to foul flatus, smelly gas, in essence. And so some people just say you have to stay away. But that is also a function of the microbiome and a function of your digestive capacity. But what that means is that for some people, the search is on for a pill, or alternatively, some people may say, I want to really augment my intake of these things. I want to eat, lots of cruciferous vegetables, a lot of broccoli sprouts, and I have all the other cruciferous vegetables, but I need to take a supplement. So, there's a bit of a problem with that. And that was highlighted in a recent study. The study compared the use of broccoli sprouts, which are a known source of sulforaphane, to a broccoli supplement in a crossover study design. And this was published in a journal called Pharmacological Research. And what they found, disappointingly, was that broccoli sprouts were a far better delivery system than a broccoli supplement in this study. They say in the prologue, broccoli consumption may reduce the risk of various cancers, and many broccoli supplements are now available. So they tested one of the most popular ones, and I have to say, I was disappointed in this study because for a long time I have recommended a product called BroccoMax. BroccoMax is made by a company called Gero. And that particular product came up short. In this study, the authors reported that only 19% of the sulforaphane was recovered after consumption of the broccoli powdered capsule compared to 74% after consumption of the broccoli sprouts. So what's going on here? Well, the problem is that in order to get sulforaphane, you have to take a precursor called glucoraphanin, and you have to convert it to sulforaphane. And the enzyme that does that is called myrosinase. Now, myrosinase is actually present in many cruciferous vegetables. And it's particularly high in certain foods. It's high in broccoli sprouts, and it's also high in cauliflower sprouts. I don't see anybody selling cauliflower sprouts, but that's another option. And it is also high in horseradish, daikon, which is a large white radish. Some people may not even know what it is, but it's popular in Asian cooking, particularly Japanese. You'll see it at Asian markets. It's also popular in a sushi spice, which is wasabi. Wasabi is that green stuff that's, if you accidentally, just say, oh, that looks like something really good, and you pop it in your mouth, you can just, it'll take the whole top of your head off. You'll break into a sweat, you'll turn red. It's very spicy. But fresh grated wasabi is, like horseradish, very spicy and is a good source of myrosinase. So is watercress, by the way. The problem with myrosinase is it's highly unstable. So when you overcook broccoli, and it doesn't take much. I mean, you may think, oh, you know, I just lightly cooked it. More than about a minute, it has to be bright green, just sort of warmed up, pretty crunchy, maybe just slightly tenderized. Very quickly, you break down the myrosinase properties. And that happens when you cook any cruciferous vegetable. Also, when you take sprouts, and say you dehydrate the sprouts, or you flash freeze them, or freeze dry them, by whatever process you put them, you render them into a capsule or powder, it destroys the myrosinase. Now, the glucoraphanin stays. It's fine. But you lack the conversion. So there's a little bit of, the body has a little bit of a backup system for that. And the backup system is that certain bacteria in your gastrointestinal tract are capable of synthesizing myrosinase to a small extent. Mm-hmm. So you consume, say, overcooked broccoli or a capsule that has glucoraphanin in it. We'll get to that later because there's another product that compares favorably with broccoli sprouts. Your own gastrointestinal flora can create enough myrosinase to render the glucoraphanin into its active sulforaphane form. So this is just a basic introduction. And in part two, I want to talk a little bit about some additional properties of sulforaphane, some fascinating new studies with sulforaphane, but also provide some solutions, because now we've said, you got to have a lot of raw sprouts or raw cruciferous vegetables, which some people don't like to consume lots of. And this particular supplement that I've been using and recommending for a long time has not, it does have some activity, it's no question, but it still compares unfavorably to broccoli sprouts. So what are the options for people desiring to increase their sulforaphane quotient and support their detoxification mechanisms? We'll talk about that in part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.